West, Wisconsin. She startled him by smiling.
It's cute.
You think so? She nodded. Know what I think? She shook her head. You need someone to fuck your brains out. She smiled again.
That's so cute. Know what I think?
Tooth leaned forward with the smile of a piranha. Tell me.
You're a nasty little perv and a lech. Go fuck yourself.
She pointed up at the ceiling. He followed her finger and saw the CCTV camera that was right on his face. He cursed. Shit, shit, shit. Fucking jet lag. How the hell had he not looked for cameras when he'd come in? Instantly, he turned and walked away in confused fury. As he reached the door, he heard her call out in a big, loud, phony southern accent.
Y'all have a nice day now.
Without turning round, he raised a hand and gave her the bird with his middle finger.
That the size of your dick?
She called after him. Tooth stepped out into the drizzle. He was fuming. Tiredness had made him screw up and potentially be noticed. He turned and stood for a moment, fighting his urge to storm back in. But that wasn't why he was here. It wasn't why he was paid to be here. He strode angrily away. Chapter 39. Sunday, the 1st of March. While Rowley lay fast asleep, snoring beside her, Jody was wide awake in bed in their luxurious cabin, sitting up with her laptop balanced on a pillow, feeling the gentle motion of the ship rocking her in the light swell, taking stock. The daily ship's program for tomorrow lay in front of her. The shore visit lecture, line dancing class, carpet bowls, craft class with Jill and Mike, bridge lessons, keep fit classes. One in particular had made her grin, titled Sit and Get Fit. The evening highlight was the comedian Alan Stewart. But she wasn't interested in any of the items. She was totally focusing on the plans she had made for her future all those years back. The rich man Cassie had said she would marry only in her dreams. Well, there was one rich man who might be dreaming right now, judging from his rapid eye movements. And this time tomorrow, she would be married to him. Sure, her right to inherit could be challenged by his family, but whatever the result, she would be coming away with a handsome chunk of change after he died. All he had to do was make it through the night. Then, from tomorrow, with a ring on her finger and the marriage certificate signed, she could make her move. She looked at him. Mouth open, droning snore, drool running from the corner of his mouth, that same self-satisfied expression that so much reminded her of her father. God, how I would love you dead. She found a diary entry she had made way back in her teens and, like all her old diaries, had scanned into a password-protected electronic document for safekeeping. This entry, she remembered, must have been just before the time she'd put a 9-inch diameter Colombian huntsman spider in Cassie's bed. The spider was totally harmless to humans, but both Cassie and her parents had a major sense of humor failure over it, and over the snakes and frogs, all harmless, that she liked to let roam free around her room. All her arachnids and reptiles, even the ones her parents had actually bought her, at her request, for birthday and Christmas presents, had been confiscated, this time permanently. Afterwards, she wrote, "There are a lot of myths about snakes, in particular about the venomous ones. Listen. The saw-scaled viper is called the world's deadliest snake, because it kills more people than any other. In India alone, it kills 58,000 people every year, 13,000 more than are killed in car crashes in the United States. But it's not actually the world's most venomous snake. That title goes to the Belcher's sea snake. One bite has enough venom to kill 1,000 people. But because it lives in the waters of Southeast Asia and Southern Australia, it rarely bites humans. The black mamba is pretty cool. It's the world's fastest snake. It moves at 12 miles per hour, and its bite can kill in 30 minutes. The king cobra can kill an elephant in an hour. The inland taipan can kill a human in 50 minutes. I love that. So many people are scared of them. Not me, though. No snake ever told me I had a hooked nose. No snake ever told me I had no tits. I don't judge them, and they don't judge me. They need me to feed and water them.
In return, they do me favours. I feel they should be rewarded for services rendered. But how do you reward a snake? What do they appreciate? Food, shelter, water? Sometimes, I think when I come back in the next life, I'd quite like to be a snake. Much less complicated. Did you ever see a snake look in a mirror and pull a face? Did you ever see a snake that had a complex about how it looked? Me neither.
Chapter 40. Sunday, the 1st of March. Tooth stood by the beach, in front of a row of shuttered Victorian arches, staring morosely through the rain out to sea. To his right was a large building site, with a central structure partially covered in scaffolding, out of which rose a construction like a huge spike soaring into the sky. A hoarding had a futuristic architect's drawing of something that looked to him like a spaceship, and the wording I-360. It reminded him of the Space Needle in Seattle. A short distance out in the sea stood a rusting mass of girders, all that remained of what had once been the West Pier. Over to his left was the Brighton Pier, and a short way along the shore past the pier, what looked like a large wheel. He smelled rotting weed and boat varnish. He found seaside resorts in the rain depressing. This place reminded him in a way of Coney Island, where he'd once spent 10 days in winter waiting for a man he'd been paid to torture and kill to show up. He didn't think there was a more depressing place on earth than Coney Island in the rain. A new smell hit his nostrils. The aroma of a grilling burger, or maybe French fries, that was making him feel hungry despite the large room service breakfast he'd eaten less than a couple of hours ago. He turned towards Brighton Pier, walking past a closed, gaily painted hut boasting the legend, in white letters on a turquoise strip, Brighton Shellfish and Oyster Bar. Head bowed against the wind, he was thinking hard about all the places a stylish woman like Jodie Bentley would visit, and where she would be known. He couldn't check the city records until tomorrow, so for now he decided to take her photograph around hotel bars, restaurants and cafes, and show it to cab drivers. The one who had driven him to Weston Road had shaken his head blankly. He walked up the steps onto the promenade and stared at the buildings across the road in front of him. A wide row of hotels and restaurants stretching for a mile or more in each direction. Right opposite him was the dark red facade of the Metropole Hotel. He crossed the road, entered, went up to the reception desk, and approached one of the uniformed males behind it. "I'm a private detective working for a U.S. law firm," he said. "We're trying to trace this lady who's come into an inheritance that she's not aware of. We don't know her name, but we believe she might be the deceased's only surviving relative." He showed photographs of Jodie Bentley. 5 minutes later, 6 different people had come to look at the photograph, and all of them had shaken their heads. He left and walked the short distance along the imposing white facade of the Grand Hotel, set behind its private parking crescent. Standing in front of the revolving door was a liveried doorman. Tooth approached him with the same story. The doorman studied the photograph carefully, then said, "Yes, I recognise her. She's been here a number of times. Charming lady. She was here last week for dinner. Let me think. Was it Wednesday? No, I was off then. Tuesday. Yes, it must have been Tuesday. Do you know her name?" "No, but she had dinner here with a gentleman. Come with me." Tooth followed the doorman inside, past the reception desk, to the restaurant entrance, where there was a smartly dressed greeter. "Michelle, this gentleman's trying to find a lady who had dinner here last Tuesday." "Right. Thank you, Colin." She looked at the photograph Tooth proffered. "Yes," she said. "Yes, she's been here a few times. Hold on a moment." She opened a large, lined register filled with names and times, and flicked back a few pages. Then she ran a finger down it and stopped. "I think this was her. The reservation was made in the gentleman's name, Mr. Rowley Carmichael. Is that right?"
"I wouldn't know," Tooth said. "What can you remember about them?"
She apologised for a moment as a group of 4 people turned up for lunch. She ticked them off her list and led them through into the restaurant. Then she returned.
"I'm trying to think. I'm afraid we have a large number of people every day. If you can wait a moment, I'll go and ask Irwin, the maitre d', if he can recall anything. Can I borrow the photograph?"
Giving her his most charming smile, he handed it over, maintaining eye contact flirtatiously. She returned a few minutes later,
Erwin remembers her, she said. She was dining with a much older gentleman, and they asked him to call 2 taxis at about 11 o'clock.
Is there a particular cab company you use? Tooth asked.
A local firm, Streamline.
Tooth thanked her. His charm offensive had got him what he wanted. He left and walked along the seafront back to his hotel. He stopped outside to smoke a cigarette, then went up to his room and ordered a pot of coffee. As he waited for it to arrive, he worked on his story. Then he picked up his phone and dialed the taxi company. Chapter 41. Sunday, the 1st of March. For the next few hours, Shelby slipped in and out of sleep. He tried several times to reach for the glass of Coke on the bedside table, but could not muster the energy. He listened to the continuous stream of cars and buses and lorries passing outside the window on the busy thoroughfare of Carden Avenue. His phone rang. It was Angie, calling to see how he was feeling and if he'd been drinking the Coke she'd left him.
Yes, he said. 2 glasses.
Well done.
He put the phone back on the table and stared at the glass, untouched since she had left. It was now 1:30 p.m. His stomach felt as if it was on fire. Weakly, he hauled himself up in bed and managed to swallow some of the drink. Then he checked his ankle again. It didn't look any worse than earlier. In fact, maybe a tiny bit better. Perhaps the antiseptic cream was helping. And maybe the way he was feeling was down to that damned bug. Dean hadn't made it to the pub on Thursday night because he'd got it. It was just a 24-hour thing. So many people had been going down with it in Sussex, it had even made the local news. He'd start feeling better soon. He had to. It was Sunday. The one night of the week, the couple in number 27 Rodine Ridge went out. He'd tailed them for the past 3 Sunday nights, driving in their large BMW down to the Rendezvous Casino in the Marina Village, where they stayed and didn't return until well after midnight, their regular pattern. He'd found out from contacts that the secluded property belonged to a Bent Brighton antiques jeweller. There had to be rich pickings in that house for sure, and if he went in early enough, after they'd left, he would have sufficient time to find them. In another few weeks the clocks would go forward, which meant an hour less of darkness in the early evening. He had planned to go there tonight to see if they went out again. He had to pull himself together and do it. He grabbed the glass and drank down the remaining contents with difficulty. Then he fell back into a sleep, full of weird dreams in which hissing, crackling snakes spun across the floor like Catherine wheels that had fallen off their pins and were spitting sparks and flames. He woke again, drenched in sweat, at 4:03 p.m., with another nosebleed. He had to get up, somehow. He could not allow Angie to come home and take him to the emergency doctor. He didn't want the risk of having to lie to a doctor about where he worked, and then have her phone them. Up! He hauled himself out of bed, placed his feet on the carpeted floor, then stood up. Instantly he sat back down again with a thump. Shit. He stood up once more. His stomach, heaving, ran into the bathroom and sat on the toilet. He remembered something a cellmate had once said to him. When the bottom falls out of your world, come to Calcutta and let the world fall out of your bottom. He stood up and peered down, and a shiver ran through him. The toilet was full of blood. He flushed it, then stepped into the shower feeling scared. What the hell was going on? Was this the bug, or was it some kind of a reaction to the bite? And when was it going to stop? The powerful stream of hot water made him feel a little better. He dried himself, then saw fresh blood was still coming out of his 2-day-old shaving nick. He put more styptic pencil on it, then, to be sure, a larger strip of plaster, rolled deodorant under his arms, and ran a hand across his damp stubble of hair. Feeling slightly human again, he dressed in his dark clothes and trainers and went downstairs. The 2 large tumblers of Coke that Angie had poured were on the kitchen table. He sat and sipped the first, slowly, thinking about the blood in the toilet. He must have burst a blood vessel in his backside, he decided. Comforted by that explanation, he drained the glass and began to work, as Angie had instructed, on the second. After a couple of sips, he started to feel hungry. He stood up and walked unsteadily over to the fridge and opened the door. But everything he looked at, a wedge of cheddar, a lettuce, a carton of tomatoes, a packet of ham, some eggs, sausages, bacon, a supermarket moussaka, all made him feel queasy again. He closed the door, thinking. Maybe a joint might make him feel better. Kill or cure. He stood up on a chair and reached for the tin marked bread where Angie kept her stash. He lifted it down, put it on the table, removed the packet of cigarette papers, a plastic bag full of weed, and a strip of cardboard, and rolled himself a fat joint. Knowing she would not be happy, he replaced the stash in the tin and put it back on the shelf, then went out into the tiny back garden to smoke it. Yes!
Wow! Oh, wow! That was powerful stuff! Wowee!
When Angie arrived home, just after 6:30 p.m, he was standing in front of the television in the sitting room, with his fists balled, dancing to the sound of the Eagles, peaceful, easy feeling blasting from the speakers.
You're feeling better? She greeted him joyfully.
Magic, he said, still dancing. Magic, that Coke.
He took her in his arms and nuzzled her neck.
You know what? You're a genius. Magician. Will you marry me?
You already asked me that, and I said yes. Did you forget?
Just checking, he said.
Checking?
In case you'd gone off me during the night.
In sickness and in health, she said. The marriage vows. Okay. I'll be sick one day too. Will that turn you off me?
Never.
What time are you off to work?
He glanced at his watch.
At 7:30. Just under an hour.
Have you eaten anything?
No, but I'm ravenous.
I've defrosted a moussaka, okay?
Oh, I'm so hungry I could eat the carton.
I'll save that, in case you want to roll another joint, she said tartly.
Then he realized, despite his elaborate precautions of replacing everything in the bread tin and smoking it outside, he'd stubbed it out in the ashtray on the kitchen table. Chapter 42. Sunday, the 1st of March. The woman who answered the Streamline Taxi Company phone could not have been more helpful after Tooth explained his predicament in the very posh English accent he had practiced for an hour before he made the call.
Oh, hello. This is Andrew Moseley, General Manager of the Grand. We have a slightly delicate situation. Last Tuesday night, we had a couple dining here who were, how should I say it, playing away. You sent two cabs, booked in the name of Carmichael, just after 11 p.m. One collected a gentleman, the other a lady. I'm afraid the lady's in a bit of a state. She's just rung to say that during the course of the dinner she lost the very expensive engagement ring her husband had given her. She thinks she took it off in the lady's toilet when she washed her hands. He's due back tomorrow from a business trip, and she's terrified he'll go berserk if she's not wearing it. Luckily, one of our cleaners found it on the floor, but of course we've had no idea, until she just rang, who it belonged to. She's desperate to have it returned, but in her panic she forgot to give us her address or phone number. Could you possibly trace the booking and find out her address for me? And I'll get someone to run it over to her this afternoon.
Chapter 43. Sunday, the 1st of March. Shelby clipped on his seatbelt, then reversed his Fiat Panda out of the driveway and onto the street. Normally, Angie would stand in the doorway to wave him off, but tonight, angry at him, she'd even turned her head sideways when he kissed her goodbye. He struggled with the gear lever, crunching the gears loudly as he tried to engage first. Then the car bunny-hopped forward and stalled. He pressed the clutch in and twisted the key. The engine turned over and fired. As he started forward, the car bunny-hopping again, he heard the almost deafening blast of a horn as a van shot past him, nearly taking out a car coming in the opposite direction. Shit. He checked his mirrors. Nothing behind him now. He accelerated, and again the car jerked forward. Handbrake, he realized, and released it. Then he drove on, winding down past a pub called the Long Man of Wilmington, his vision blurry. He leaned forward in the darkness, peering through the windscreen, and switched on the wipers. But the screen was clear. Headlights came towards him. Two of them suddenly became four. He swerved slightly to the left, and the car juddered over the curb and onto the pavement. Shit, shit, shit. He steered back onto the road, missing a tree by inches. He was clammy with perspiration.
Ahead was a mini roundabout, and suddenly he could not remember where he was supposed to be going.
Rodine. Kemp Town.
He halted at the roundabout. There was nothing coming to his right. But he stayed there, eyes trying to focus. Checking, then double-checking the road was clear. Then he heard an impatient toot behind him. He wound down his window, pushed his arm out, and gave the car behind two fingers.
"Fuck you!" he said.
Suddenly a shadow loomed towards him, a man towering over him. Shelby smashed the gear lever into first and jerked forward, turning left into London Road, accelerating hard. He saw red tail lights ahead, bright headlights coming towards him, one set after another, each so bright they felt like they were burning his retinas, as if he was staring at the sun through binoculars.
"Dim your lights!" he shouted. "Dim your lights, bastards! Dim your lights!"
Then red lights in front were growing brighter, brighter, brighter still.
Shit!
He stamped as hard as he could on the brake pedal. The little Fiat slewed forward, its tyres squealing, and came to a halt just inches from the tailgate of the lorry right in front of him. He sat still, his whole body palpitating, his head swimming. After a minute or so, the lorry moved forward again, over the green traffic light and on past Preston Park. He ought to turn round, he knew. He wasn't up to this. Turn round, go back to Angie, go back to bed. But he drove on, fighting it, trying desperately to concentrate, to focus.
"Focus!"
he shouted at himself. His voice sounded strange, sort of echoing around inside his skull. He stared at the taillights of the lorry, imagining it was towing him, that there was a long rope between them he needed to keep taut, no slack. He was safe all the time he stayed behind this vehicle. Just follow it. Follow it. He braked when it braked, accelerated when it accelerated. They crossed over more green traffic lights, stopped at a red, moved on, keeping that rope taut. But the lorry indicated right.
"Gosh, bye,"
Shelby slurred. He was going the other way. Left. East. Then he frowned. He was at a roundabout. Right in front of him were the dazzling lights of Brighton Pier.
Shit!
He'd come too far, totally missed the earlier turn-off he'd intended taking into Edward Street.
Bugger! Shit!
But no matter. He could go along Marine Parade instead. He continued to stare at the lights of the pier and of the Brighton Wheel to the left. So many lights! Like 1,000 torches all beaming straight into his eyes! He heard the toot of a horn behind him. He put the car into gear and stalled it. He pushed in the clutch and the engine turned over without firing. There was another toot behind him, louder and longer. He twisted the key in the ignition and the engine again turned over without firing.
"No, don't do this to me. Do not fucking do this to me."
Headlights flashed behind him now, flooding the interior of the car with a light so bright it was blinding him. Another blare of the horn. He tried again, and the engine stuttered into life, backfired, then caught. Drenched in perspiration, he crunched the car into gear and jerked forward, and then stalled again. He was losing track of where he was and why he was here. He'd engaged third instead of first. The lights behind him again flashed angrily. He started the car once more, got first, then shot forward, right in front of a taxi coming across the roundabout, which also flashed its lights and hooted angrily at him. He accelerated hard onto Marine Parade, the front of the taxi filling his mirrors, still flashing its lights and hooting at him in fury. He changed up a gear, holding the accelerator pedal to the floor, looking at the lights behind him, in front of him, all around him, mesmerized. Two big orange globes like setting suns loomed ahead. Then, right in front of him, almost in silhouette, he saw a woman pushing a buggy.
Zebra crossing!
The orange globes. The woman staring at him, frozen. He was closing on her. His foot stamped on the brake pedal, but it wasn't the brake. It was the accelerator. He swung the steering wheel wildly to the left. Almost instantly, the car stopped dead with a massive jolt, a metallic boom, and simultaneously, a loud bang, like a gunshot. He smelled cordite. Had he been shot? He could see nothing through the windscreen, except for the buckled bonnet pushed right up. Had he killed the woman and the child? He stared, bewildered around him, his ears popping. Then, in the moments before he passed out, he noticed what looked like a large spent condom hanging out of the steering wheel. Or it could have been an octopus. He heard someone shouting.
Then a massive bang above him sent his head crashing forward into the wheel. Chapter 44. Sunday, the 1st of March. The wind had died down, and the rain had stopped, as Tooth climbed out of the taxi at the junction of Rodine Road and Rodine Crescent. He gave the driver a 10% tip, knowing he was more likely to remember the people who didn't tip than the ones who did, and strolled off into the darkness. He wore lycra beneath his clothes, and a hairnet beneath his baseball cap, to minimise any risk of dropping anything that could give an investigating team his DNA. There were smart, detached houses all around, mostly mock Tudor, reminding him of houses in Beverly Hills where he had once done a hit, and where he had met his dog. This was a much more likely place for Jodie Bentley to be residing than Western Road, he thought. He turned right into Rodine Crescent and began to walk along it, looking at the house numbers and counting them down until he reached number 191. He stared at it. The house sat a short distance below the street. There was an alarm box high up on the front wall. A light was on in an upstairs window, and another downstairs. A swanky place, architecturally in keeping with the neighbourhood, and with an integral double garage. There was a builder's sign by the entrance, and scaffolding had been erected along one side of the house. Behind the scaffolding, one first-floor window looked securely boarded up. He stood still, watching the house for several minutes for any signs of movement inside. To his right he saw a bobbing light and the flash of a high-vis jacket under a street lamp, an approaching cyclist. He took a few tentative steps down the tarmac driveway, keeping close to the bushes on the right. The cyclist passed. A few seconds later he heard a car. He held his breath, ready to step right into the bushes. But it carried on along the road above him. He hurried down the drive and into the porch, rang the front doorbell, and heard a faint, shrill ring. It was followed by silence. No frantic barking of a dog, which was good. He didn't like having to kill dogs. It wasn't their fault their owners were assholes. After some moments, he rang again. A third time. Then a fourth time. A real long ring. He pushed open the letterbox and peered through. The place had a feminine look about it. Parquet flooring. Contemporary furniture. Modern art on the walls. No sign of life. He'd figured that most likely she lived on her own and was out right now. On a date? Gone to a movie? Away for the weekend? In another home she also owned, perhaps? With gloved hands, he pulled from his pocket a tool he had made himself some years back. Its shell was the casing of a Swiss Army penknife. If any customs officer had searched his hold luggage, they would have dismissed this innocuous-looking piece of a traveller's kit. But he had removed all of its tools, apart from the large blade, to which he had fitted a locking device, turning it into a flick knife, the marlin spike, which also could lock into place, and was the perfect length to stab someone through the eye or ear and pierce their brain, the screwdriver and the scissors, which always came in handy. The rest of the tools were replaced with his set of lockpicks. If he needed further proof about the dubious nature of the occupant of this house, it was in the length of time it took him to work away at the three heavy-duty locks that secured the front door. It was a full 5 minutes before it finally swung open. He stepped into the hall, the spike protruding between his fingers, and closed the door behind him, listening for any beeps of the alarm being triggered. Then he clocked the internal keypad on the wall close to the door. A steady green light was glowing. It had not been set. Was someone in the house? He called out loudly, and, "Hello?" Silence. The house had an empty feel and was cold. Scattered on the floor was a small amount of junk mail and one brown official-looking envelope addressed to the occupier. Nothing else. Switching on his torch, he went through a door on the right into a tidy living room. There were two modern white sofas, a curved screen television on the wall, a coffee table on which sat a glass ashtray and two framed photographs on the mantelpiece above a large fireplace with an empty grate. One photograph was of a grey and white cat curled on a rug on the floor. The other was a woman in jeans and a black roll neck, grinning at the photographer, with an enormous python coiled round her neck and part of her body. He didn't need to check the photographs he had in his inside pocket to know this woman was his target, the woman using the names Jodie Bentley and Judith Forshaw. He went back into the hall and down a short corridor on the far side which led to a washroom. Then, further along the hall, he entered a large high-tech kitchen with an island unit in the centre. Lying on it was a notepad with a blank top sheet of paper and several previous pages torn from it. In a corner, on a shelf next to a fancy oven range with an induction hob that looked like it had never been used, was a cordless handset sitting in an answering machine cradle. The display showed no messages. He picked up the handset and opened the calls list. It was empty. Maybe, like himself, she only used a cell phone and kept this landline for emergencies, he speculated. He noticed a strange square stainless steel machine that looked like it belonged in a laboratory rather than a kitchen. It had a raised section in the middle with several tube connectors and a heavy-duty porthole on the front with a row of dials and switches beside it. The manufacturer's name on it was Lyophilizer, and the model number was Labgo MN4. It was a freeze dryer. Why did she have one of these, he wondered. On a work surface, there was a box of cat food pouches. She had a cat. Where was it? Inside or out? Or was it here at all? Had she gone away and taken the cat with her? Or put it in a cattery? He went over to the fridge. It was one of those big American fridge-freezer affairs, all plumbed in with an ice and cold water dispenser on the outside. He opened the door and peered in, interested to see what the sell-by dates of its contents were. He noticed a pack of smoked salmon, eggs, butter, an open carton of soya milk, and a half-empty bottle of skimmed milk, with four more days of life according to the date stamp, some apples, blueberries, and grapes. Opening the bottom freezer section, he recoiled in revulsion. It was full of packs of dead mice and rats. He loathed these creatures. He hated rodents, vermin. What were they doing here? Treats for the cat? Was that the reason for the freeze dryer? He closed it, turned away, and opened an internal door which led to a large garage housing a dark blue Mercedes 500 SL convertible, shiny clean. He had a good look around the garage, then went back into the house, going upstairs and continuing his search. There was a landing with a wall at the far end and five rooms leading off. He checked each of them in turn. A bedside light, plugged into a timer switch in a large bedroom, was on. It was as luxurious but as sterile as a hotel room. Three guest bedrooms equally could have belonged in a hotel. Then a small den with a desk, bookshelves, wiring for a computer which wasn't there, and a router. Something struck him as strange. There were barely any photographs anywhere in the house, only the two in the living room. He went through all the drawers in the desk. In one, he found two bunches of keys, both with a yellow tag marked front door. He pocketed one set. Next, he checked the bookshelves. There were companies that sold fake books with hollow interiors where you could hide things like jewellery and keys, but all the books were real. He went back out onto the landing and shone his torch up and down, noticing some scratches low down on the wall at the end of the landing. Curious, he walked up to it and knelt. His training as a sniper in the US Army had honed his eye to look for anything out of the usual in any environment he found himself in. Any signs that someone else might be there, maybe waiting to kill him. Something had been scratching away at the paintwork, but only up to a height of about 2 feet. He thought about the pouches of cat food on the countertop. Had the cat been scratching? Why? Was there a mouse in the cavity beyond? He shone the beam of the torch over it. He'd learned to read tracks in the ground, animal and human tracks, fresh tracks and old tracks. Some of these scratches were recent, some much older. A family of mice, or maybe rats, breeding in the cavity? He rapped on the wall. It was hollow. He thought about the layout of the house, the scaffolding outside, with the boarded-up window. But he'd not seen a boarded-up window in any of the rooms he'd been in. He went downstairs and outside, and looked up at the scaffolding. The boarded window was, he realized, on the other side of that wall. What was behind it? What was the cat so anxious to get at? Chapter 45. Sunday, the 1st of March. PC's Jenny Dunn and Craig Johnson, responding on blue lights and wailing siren to the Grade 1 call, saw several cars pulled up ahead, just past the roundabout in front of the brightly lit Brighton Pier. A knot of people stood around, several of them vulture-like, as was usual these days at an accident scene, taking photographs on their phones. As they drew close, slowing down, they saw a small Fiat embedded in a lamppost a short distance from a zebra crossing, its rear sticking out into the road at a skewed angle. The top half of the lamppost had snapped off, crushing the roof of the car. Both unclipped their seatbelts before the patrol car had come to a full halt. Jenny Dunn pulled on the handbrake, and Johnson switched the response car's lights to their stationary flashing mode. They jumped out, all their training for this kind of incident kicking in, and ran forward. It looked like a single-vehicle RTC. Sunday night in central Brighton, possibly a drunk driver. Some of the onlookers, enjoying the last hours of the weekend, certainly looked like they'd had a drink or two. The ones standing out in the road were in danger themselves. A man in jeans and a bomber jacket was tugging frantically at the Fiat's jammed driver's door. As quickly as possible, they needed to establish the status of anyone inside the car, clear the area around it, call the ambulance service, if no one had already called them, and, from the look of the impact, even from here, the fire and rescue would be needed too, with their cutting gear. They pushed their way urgently through the growing crowd.
"I saw it happen," a man shouted at them. "Bastard nearly killed me and me kid," shouted a woman with a pushchair.
They ran up to the car. It was an old model Fiat Panda, its bonnet embedded in a V-shape into the lamppost, the broken top half of which had partially flattened the roof. One person unconscious in the driver's seat, his head pinned at an unnatural angle by buckled steel against the steering wheel. PC Dunn shone her torch in and saw the limp white airbag. A chill ran through her.
"Oh, shite," she said in her strong Northern Irish accent.
PC Johnson ran back to the car to grab a roll of police cordon tape. PC Dunn radioed for an ambulance and fire and rescue service, and was told both were already on their way. Chapter 46. Sunday, the 1st of March. "Remember," Johnny Spelt had said earlier that afternoon to the director of the latest TV crew who had been shadowing them for the past week, making a documentary about the Kent, Surrey and Sussex Air Ambulance Service, "the pilot is always the best-looking person aboard the helicopter." In the restroom at the rear of the hangar at Redhill Aerodrome, where the duty crew relaxed between call-outs, the pilots in green and the medics in red jumpsuits were seated around the table, ribbing Spelt for his remarks.
"Best looking,"
said D. Springer, a short, ginger-haired Australian who was over in the UK on secondment, training for a career as a flying doctor back in her homeland.
"In your dreams."
"So in that case," said Declan MacArthur, a tall young doctor with a shaven head and easy smile, "I guess we're going to have to switch roles, Johnny."
"Ha ha."
He bit into his cheese and pickle sandwich. It had been a long day and they were all tired. In an average 24 hours, the air ambulance was called out 5 times. But today, in addition to interviews with the documentary film crew, they'd done 5 on their shift alone. The last to a motorcyclist suffering severe head injuries after a collision with a van in Eastbourne. They'd flown him to the best specialist unit for head trauma in the southeast of England, St George's in Tooting, and had only just returned. In 30 minutes, they would be going off duty. Exhausted, they were all hoping there would not be another call. The best chance patients have of recovering fully from severe head injuries is to be treated within 4 hours. Had the motorcyclist been transported by road, by the time the ambulance had reached and transferred him, it would have been a good 4 hours and probably longer. The helicopter crew had him on the operating table in just under 90 minutes. "Declan," the former military pilot said good-humouredly, "you want to take the controls? Be my guest. So long as I'm not on board when you do.
Wuss." "Live dangerously for once, Johnny," D. Springer said.
"Live dangerously," the pilot retorted. "I flew missions in Afghanistan, okay?"
"Respect."
Declan MacArthur raised his hands.
Yeah, I'll grant you that, the Australian said. So, don't you find this work a bit tame after a war zone?
You know what I like about this job, Johnny replied.
No, but I think you're about to tell us, said Declan.
It's very nice to land a helicopter without anyone shooting at you.
Suddenly, the purple phone in the room rang. Bollocks, the doctor said, checking his watch as he walked over to answer it. Just a few more minutes and we'd be off shift. Typical.
Bad attitude, chided the pilot.
Chapter 47. Sunday, the 1st of March. Tooth, standing on the wooden platform on the first floor level of the scaffolding, heard the distinct thrashing of an approaching helicopter. A short while earlier, listening to the howl of sirens, he had waited, concealed in the garden, holding the chisel and hammer he had found in the garden shed in case they were coming to this house. But some distance away, the sirens had died down. Emergency vehicles attending an incident or accident of some kind. He set to work on the window boarding. Someone had done a thorough job, and it was a full 10 minutes before he'd removed enough of the wood to be able to see into the interior of the room. He didn't like what he saw. It was a very well-equipped reptile room, lined with glass vivariums, lamps, water pumps, and timer-controlled feeders. That was the reason why she had all the dead rodents in her freezer. He could see snakes, including a huge python, a boa constrictor, and some much smaller ones, spiders, frogs, and several vivariums teeming with scorpions. Nasty-looking beige ones with tiny claws. For his last mission in the army to Iraq, he'd been given a lecture on identifying these critters. The smaller the claws, the more deadly the sting. And the ones he could see in a row of vivariums lined against one wall had claws that were all but invisible. Jody Bentley had weird taste in pets, he thought. Not his thing at all. He hated all these fuckers. Not much scared him, but reptiles did. The cat had been lucky not to scratch all the way through the wall. Didn't it know the saying, curiosity killed the cat? He could see a glass door, but it looked like there was a solid wall behind it, and that made him very curious. How come she had a room that had no apparent door into it? The helicopter was coming closer. He looked up and saw the lights only a short distance away. For a moment he wondered if it was a police helicopter looking for him, and flattened himself against the house. Chapter 48. Sunday, the 1st of March. The brightly lit skyline of Brighton was dead ahead of them in the clear night sky, as the twin jet, black and white liveried MD-902 Explorer helicopter flying on visual at 155 miles per hour tracked the A23 south. Johnny Spelt, the pilot, observed the familiar night landmarks of Shoreham Power Station to the west, the Palace Pier, as he still liked to call it, and the Brighton Wheel to the east of it. It was easy to see the entire shoreline, the long necklace of streetlights, beyond which was the pitch dark of the English Channel. He lived in Brighton, and knew the geography of the city intimately. A short distance in front of the wheel was a whole cluster of flashing lights of emergency vehicles. Liaising on the radio with the police inspector on the ground, he descended to 500 feet and hovered. Below, they could see a car embedded in a lamppost, part of which had fallen on the vehicle's roof, with a cordon round the scene. Inside the cordon was an ambulance, a fire engine, and several police cars.
"Golf Kilo Sierra Sierra Alpha," crackled the inspector's voice.
"Golf Kilo Sierra Sierra Alpha," Spelt responded.
"Please land in East Brighton Park. There's a car waiting to transport you to the scene."
As he spoke, Spelt could see below them to the left the wide, dark area of the park at the bottom of Wilson Avenue. He pulled on his night vision goggles, wiggling the strap around his headset, and looked down, studying the area carefully. Apart from a figure some distance away exercising a dog with a ball thrower, and the flashing blue lights of the waiting police car, the area was deserted. Plenty of room for them. He removed the goggles and switched on the helicopter's powerful searchlight, immediately able to see the green sward of the park. 2 minutes later, they touched down. With the rotors still turning, Dee Springer and Declan MacArthur unclipped their safety harnesses, removed their headsets and hung them up. Then, clutching their bags of medical kit, they jumped out onto the grass, clambered into the rear of the waiting police car, and were driven the half mile to the accident scene. They were met at the cordon by a paramedic who briefed them quickly. His head and legs are trapped, and the fire crew's cutting him free. He appears to have severe head and spinal injuries, as well as what looks like internal hemorrhaging. The paramedic raised the blue and white police tape, and they ducked under and ran across to the car, pulling on protective gloves and barely glancing at several police officers close by. The driver's door had been cut free and was lying on the road, and two fire and rescue officers were crouched down, cutting through the front of the roof with a huge hydraulic pincer. Inside the car was a thin man, all in black, wearing a black beanie and leather gloves, his neck twisted. Dee Springer shone her torch in. The man was barely conscious. His face was the pallid colour common in any trauma victim, but blood was leaking from his eyes, nose and mouth. He was breathing in short, clearly painful bursts.
"Fubar Bundy," she said under her breath.
The gallows humour of her profession. It stood for fucked up beyond all recovery, but unfortunately not dead yet. Declan kneeled and spoke to the driver.
"Hello,"
he said. "Can you hear me?"
"Blah,"
the driver responded. "I'm a doctor. What's your name?"
"Lush."
"Can you move your arms?" The driver raised them a fraction and half closed his hands. Declan heard the crackle of a radio and a siren wailing in the distance coming closer. "We'll have you out in a few minutes and we're going to fly you to hospital." Normal practice with trauma victims was to inject them with a ketamine-based anesthetic to restrict the capillaries and reduce blood loss. Clearly, some major internal bleeding was occurring. He peeled off the man's left glove to take his pulse, then stared in shock for some moments as he looked at the man's hand in the beam of his colleague's torch. Blood was leaking out under his fingernails. He curled his finger round the man's wrist and quickly found the median nerve. He'd been expecting him to have a weak pulse, but to his surprise, it was hammering, dangerously. He counted, checking against his watch. 180, he estimated broadly after counting for 20 seconds, enough to kill someone with a heart condition or give them a stroke. He looked back at the man's bleeding eyes. His pupils were hugely dilated. "Have you been taking any drugs?" he asked gently.
"Lush. Lush."
Without warning, he coughed up a large globule of bright blood which spattered on the white, sagging airbag. The doctor's brain was racing. The man must have taken something, but what? Brighton was a party town. He'd attended people in a bad way here before, clubbers who'd swallowed a whole cocktail of stuff they'd bought from street dealers, but he'd never before seen symptoms quite like this. "Can you tell me what you've taken tonight?" he asked, firmly but calmly.
"Fog,"
the man murmured. His voice was almost drowned out by the grinding sound of the hydraulic cutter.
"Could you say that again?"
"Frog."
"Frog?"
Dee said, very gently, kneeling beside him.
"Did you see a frog?"
she coaxed. The whites of his eyes were veined with red, and blood ran like tears from between his lids.
"Frog. Snake."
"You saw a frog and a snake? Have you taken any drugs tonight?"
The man's eyes were closing. Declan took his pulse again. The rate was lower this time. He wasn't sure whether this was a good or bad sign. He'd never encountered anything like this. He asked his colleague for the syringe and ketamine.
"Shankle,"
the man said suddenly.
"Shankle."
"Stay with us," Dee said. "Please stay awake and tell us as much as you can remember. What have you taken?"
"I think he said ankle," Declan said. He looked at the man's face.
"Is that it? Your ankle?"
But his eyes were shut now, and he no longer responded. The doctor leaned into the footwell with his torch, pulled up the man's trouser legs, and pushed his socks down. He could see swelling and bruising round the right ankle and two tiny pinprick marks. "Have you injected yourself?" he asked, but got no reply. He then checked his pulse again. It was dropping at an alarming rate. Dee tapped him on the shoulder and signalled for him to move out of earshot of the patient. As he stepped a couple of paces back from the car, Dee Springer said,
"Look, I think he's been poisoned. either taken some drug or eaten something. I heard of symptoms like this from someone who'd eaten a pufferfish that hadn't been prepared properly. Could it be something highly toxic like that?
Take a look at his ankle. I think he's injected something or possibly been bitten by something very small, and I don't know what to give him, Declan said. Normally calm, able to cope with any victim, however bad his or her condition, he seemed close to panic at this moment. The possibility was also going through his mind that this man might have some kind of tropical disease that could be contagious. If so, there was no way they could take him in the helicopter and risk contaminating it for future patients. Dee leaned close to the victim.
Sir, we're going to help you get better, but we need you to tell us what's happened. Did you eat something tonight? Have you taken any drugs? Has something bitten you? Have you been abroad recently?
There was no response.
She stepped back and said to the doctor, We need to get him to the poisons unit at Guy's in London. That's my view.
Declan checked the man's pulse again. It had dropped to 35. 180 down to 35 in the space of minutes. Guy's was an hour's flying time away. It would be close to 10 p.m. by the time they got him there. They would radio the patient's symptoms ahead of their arrival, giving the hospital time to get a specialist team on standby. But if he had a tropical disease, which might be contagious, could they take the risk of him contaminating the helicopter? They had to give it a go, he decided. They always gave it a go, and more often than they sometimes dared to believe. They succeeded. Those were the sweetest moments, the reason they all did this job. Chapter 49. Sunday, the 1st of March. Tooth found it after 20 minutes of meticulous searching. The remote control was at the back of a shelf above a row of dresses in dust protectors, hanging in a closet in a spare room. When he stood out on the landing and pressed it, the wall at the end began to move sideways, slowly, steadily, to reveal a glass door, the one he had seen through the window. He stood, waiting until it was fully open, and stepped forward. Through the glass, to his disgust, he could see the containers of reptiles. He waited some moments, just in case something in there had gotten out, then armed himself with the locked blade of his knife and stepped in through the glass door, instantly screwing up his nose at the rank, sour smell of the creatures housed there. He shone his beam around, all the time keeping a wary ear open in case the woman suddenly returned, but even more of a wary eye on the floor and up at the ceiling, in case anything roamed free in here. A large humidifier in the centre of the floor made a steady hum. The atmosphere was damp and warm, tropical. There were some broken vivariums on the floor, and on a shelf above them were several different sized snake hooks. A pair of heavy-duty, long-sleeved gloves hung from a peg. Apart from this small area and the window area, the rest of the room was stacked to the ceiling and wall to wall with glass vivariums. Each was plumbed into a water system with its own lighting, and most of the creatures inside appeared motionless. Tooth's survival when he had been in the military, serving overseas in desert and jungle environments, had partly depended on not being bitten by anything venomous, and he had a fairly good knowledge of dangerous reptiles and arachnids. In one of the containers, with a habitat of small rocks, sand and plants, was a shiny black spider, about 3 inches across, with a leathery-looking black sack on its back, shaped like a rugby ball. A funnel web, he recognized. Capable of killing in 15 minutes. In another miniature tropical forest, he saw the ugly black carapace of a large scorpion. Without a swift antidote, its sting would be fatal to even a strong, fit human. Another section of vivariums with misted sides contained several small, ochre-coloured frogs with black eyes. Golden dart frogs, he knew, reckoned to be one of the most deadly creatures in the world. Next to them was a stack of vivariums containing small snakes, saw-scaled vipers. Against the far wall was the biggest of the containers, a good 6 foot square, with tropical plants in it, housing a huge sleeping python, with a bulge in its midriff. A rodent from the freezer. In another container were brown cockroaches. It was filled with the disgusting creatures, each of them a good 2 inches long, all crawling over each other. Yuck. Not much made him shudder, but being in this room did. And his head was full of questions. Why was the window boarded up? To stop light getting in? Or to maintain the secrecy? Why keep this room secret? You only kept something a secret that you wanted to hide. What did Jody Bentley want to hide? These creatures? Or something else? He went back out of the room, closed the doors, and replaced the remote where he had found it. He spent the next 3 hours searching through each of the rooms in turn, careful to leave no trace. He found nothing. Back in the hall, he stood still, thinking. Was the memory stick, and maybe the cash too, hidden in one of those glass containers, guarded by one of the host of venomous creatures in there? He wasn't about to go sticking his hand in any of them, gloves or no gloves. He'd wait until Jody Bentley came home and get her to do that for him. Without gloves. Or were the cash and the stick even here at all? Perhaps she'd stashed them in a safe deposit box somewhere. He looked at his watch. It was 10 past midnight, late for someone to be out on a Sunday night, particularly a grieving widow. Where was she? Where the hell was the stuff? Where would he have put those items himself? There were a million possibilities in a house this large. The reptile room was just one of them. It could be up in a roof space, or in the garden, buried someplace. He could search for a week and still find nothing. He needed Jody. Within 10 minutes of finding her, having her alone in a room, she'd tell him. She'd be begging to tell him, screaming it out. No one he'd ever gone to for information had remained silent. Back in the kitchen, he looked again at the notepad he'd seen earlier on the island unit. Looked at it closely. There were faint indentations. He went over to the fridge and found in a drawer in the vegetable section what he'd been hoping for, lemons, inside a string net. He removed one, cut it in half, and began to squeeze hard, letting the juice fall over the indentations on the sheet of paper at the top of the notepad. When he was happy that it was saturated, he discarded both halves of the lemon in his pocket to avoid leaving any fibres from his gloves, went over to the oven, switched on the fan to 170 degrees, and put the page inside. Every few minutes he opened the oven door and peered in. Finally, he smiled and removed the page, putting it on the top of the hob. He switched the oven off and stared down at the clear brown writing that had appeared as if by magic. It was a conjuring trick he had learned as a child. Organza, Emirates, 442 Dubai, 1135 LHR, passport. Instantly, he googled the name Organza on his phone. Organza fabric, Organza gift bags, Organza cruise ship, our flagship addition to our fleet, Orient and Occident cruise lines. Was that where the grieving widow had gone? Spending a chunk of her 200,000 stolen counterfeit dollars to help her through her grief. How sweet. How long was she going to be away? Certainly long enough for him to take this house apart. He didn't know how long you could leave a collection of reptiles for, even with timers fitted. A few days, probably. A week. But not much more. Either she had someone who would come in to look after them, who could almost certainly provide him with useful information, or she was planning to be back in a week, or perhaps two at the most. He'd look up the Organza's schedule on his computer back in his hotel room and check out the ports of call. Tomorrow, he decided, he'd come and have a chat with the builders, see what he could find out from them. He looked forward to her return, to see what choice cuts he could take from her back home to Yossarian. He liked to reward his associate for his patience in waiting for him with body parts from his victims. And thanks to her well-equipped kitchen, he might be able to take something really tasty. Freeze-dried. Chapter 50. Monday, the 2nd of March. Tooth arrived back in his hotel room shortly after 1 a.m., tired now and getting increasingly angry. Angry with the rain, angry with the goddamn cold, angry that he had totally failed to find what he was looking for, and angry he had got a splinter in his finger putting the window boarding back. He ordered steak and fries, coffee, and a bottle of Maker's Mark bourbon from room service, and stood by the window, looking down at the lights of Brighton seafront and the black water of the English Channel beyond. While he waited for his meal and drink to arrive, he was planning to return to Jodie Bentley's house and make a search of every inch of the property. The memory stick could be anywhere. The bitch might have it with her, of course. That was a possibility. He'd searched plenty of residences and offices in his time. He knew all the places where people hid stuff, thinking they were being clever, like fake books, bathroom cabinets, sock drawers, on top of kitchen cupboards, in empty containers, under floorboards. Mostly when people hid stuff, there were indications. You'd see the tiny indent in a floorboard where a screwdriver had been inserted, the books not entirely flush, clothes stacked a little bit too neatly at the back of the drawer. But tonight, nothing. Nada. Goose eggs. After the room service guy had delivered his tray and departed, Tooth hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the door, then, standing on a table, taped over the smoke detector. He sat down at the table and poured himself a large whiskey, then, using the coffee cup saucer as an ashtray, lit a lucky strike, flipped open the lid of his laptop, and googled organza, adding cruise ship. Moments later, an image appeared of a sleek white liner with a single rectangular funnel. He typed the words itinerary, March. The ship had sailed from Dubai yesterday, bound for Mumbai, India, due to arrive in 3 days' time. The itinerary carried on for months, the ship steadily making its way to Cape Town, then up the west coast of Africa, then across to Ascension Island, and on to Rio de Janeiro. It was a round-the-world cruise. But there was no way Jodie Bentley would be staying on it for all that time. He looked at the different legs and journey times. If she disembarked in Mumbai, she could be home in 4 days. If it was Goa, that would be 6 days at least before she'd be back. It looked like he had a minimum of 4 days to occupy himself in this freezing, wet hellhole. 4 days to search her place again, if there was any point. He stared at his meal, the room filled with the smell of it, and wished he was back home in the sunshine on his boat with Yusarian, the trawl line stretched out behind him, catching healthy food for them both. He drained his glass, refilled it, and lit another lucky strike. A printed sign warned him there was a £250 fine for smoking in this room. As he dragged on his cigarette, he began to form a plan. He turned back to his laptop. Chapter 51. Monday, the 2nd of March. At lunchtime that day, at a private ceremony in the intimate Polaris bar, Rollo and Jodie were married by the organza's captain. The service was attended by an elderly American couple as witnesses, with whom they had shared a dinner table last night, Irv and Mitzi Kravitz. Rollo slipped a wedding band in platinum, purchased from the ship's jewellery shop, onto Jodie's finger, and she had placed a ring onto his too. Throughout the entire ceremony, he had looked utterly gooey-eyed. Sweet. For the next few days of what he called their honeymoon, and she viewed more as an endurance test of feigning adoration and horniness, they would be to the outside world the besotted newlyweds. Most of their fellow passengers were either elderly couples or elderly widows, and she had noticed, since embarking on the cruise, the frequent glances thrown in her direction, some of disapproval, some of envy, at the considerable age gap between herself and her new husband. Irv had quietly asked Rollo if he was concerned about the age gap, and in reply, Rollo had quoted Joan Collins. "If she dies, she dies," he'd said. But it didn't bother her. She was focused and full of excitement about their first port of call, Mumbai, India, and especially about one choice of shore excursion listed in the ship's daily newspaper. The Mumbai Crocodile Farm. Walk through Mumbai bush to a crocodile swamp. See these prehistoric reptiles in their natural environment, and don't worry, we feed them daily on chickens, not tourists. It was one of